Good evening.
Good evening.
I would like to offer an aspiration. Let us make the aspiration that we will practice meditation, listen to and study the Dharma, and bring these together and into our lives, so we may awaken all sentient beings from the nightmare of samsara. Does everyone know what samsara means? Who? Yes?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. Samsara means suffering which recycles itself so as to be continuous. In other words, it's not just something bad happens, but samsara goes round and round, and it recreates itself, which is what we're going to talk about when we get to this wheel. So our topic for some time has been the Four Noble Truths. We are now on the second of the Four Noble Truths. The first was the truth of suffering. Have you heard that? No, okay. The first was the truth of suffering. We're now talking about the truth of the cause of suffering. And this is the third, and last week we will be talking about that. Then we come to the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering, and the fourth noble truth, which is the path.
He must read great stories about what suffering is.
Okay, yeah.
We have to go back and listen to them.
Yeah, they're online.
Yeah, it's really terrible.
Okay. Life is just really... And, maybe Adam got so sad about your life.
Yeah, he didn't come back. We lost a few people.
Well, we got to talk about the cessation of suffering. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was rain, maybe it was suffering, but we're going to be going on to cessation next week. So we study suffering and the cause of suffering so that we can understand how to end it. Not because we like to get ourselves depressed. So we may attain the cessation of suffering by following the path. And we are studying the cause of suffering so that we can then understand what to do about it. So cessation, which we will get to very soon, is good news, great news. Suffering is not necessary. We can actually end it completely. We can awaken to our original life force, blazing wakefulness, not spaced out bliss, but blazing a wakefulness, brilliant light, emotions that are free from being, conflicted, free-flowing emotions. A world which is colorful, clear, energetic, youthful. So we can awaken to get out of our stale mind and be fresh and awake all the time. But to do that, we actually have to look at suffering. So waking up takes effort. And if we actually go along the path, not only does it take effort, but there is a... We have to go beyond a wall of fear. We have to get beyond fear, which doesn't mean squashing fear, but having the courage to go through fear. We need to be able to look straight at samsara, the suffering and the cycling of it, understand how it works, and then we can see not only that it's awful, but that it's unnecessary. So some glimpse of cessation can be very helpful for that purpose. So this is sort of a repeat up to here. Does that make sense? But we do have a varying audience from week to week. So samsara is a very heavy burden. We've been carrying it so long, according to traditional Buddhist teachings, we've been carrying it through endless lifetimes. So long that we've forgotten what it might be like not to have to carry this terrible burden. That's why we need a little glimpse of what it would be like to lay down this burden, because it's not necessary. So by looking at the cause of suffering, we have the possibility of liberation. And this is very different than trying to fix things up. If you recall the four-lined Dharma of Gampopa that Emily recited at the beginning of the meditation, it said, I'm going to go over just this is something that can be understood in deeper and deeper ways as we progress. So the first understanding of it is, grant your blessing so that my mind may be one with the Dharma, that we're actually going to take our mind and use it to look at Dharma. Grant your blessing so that Dharma may progress along the path, which is that it actually changes us. The study is not just intellectual, it actually changes us. And then it says, grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. Now this is extremely important, because it doesn't say, grant your blessings so that we can fix up confusion or patch it up or repair it. So what that means is that when we look at our mind, we don't say, oh, this is terrible, I'm going to go change it. Our mind is actually fine as it is. We see the suffering and we just leave it in its place. We don't say, oh, this isn't so good, I'm going to start to manipulate it. If we do that, we lose spontaneity. We have the possibility of interfering with our functioning, or becoming rather repressed personalities. So we don't want to do that. We really want to give our mind a chance to go wild eventually, to trust it. So grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. And finally, grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom, which means we don't have to do anything. It clarifies and transforms itself. And we start to go beyond our intentional efforts at that point, which is means things are rolling along in a different sort of way. The practice has overtaken us instead of our being practitioners. Oh, did I say something awful? Tell me.
No, I'm just thinking about what you said.
What are you thinking?
Well, you know, just that it's not us deliberately trying to make the change, that through this practice, it just, change will happen.
Yeah.
Is that kind of
a
fair way to say it?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was last week,
talk a little louder. Yes, please.
Your is not meaning a higher being. When you say grant your blessing, you're not saying that to a higher being.
Right.
Your is to your higher self.
Yes.
So I just thought I'd...
Yes, that's right. But it's a higher self which, if we try to invent that higher self, it turns out not to be a higher self, but to be our own... little version of it. Our mind is very clever at turning the Dharma or turning anything into a fix-up project. trying to reinvent ourselves. And we're trying to leave ourselves alone and not reinvent ourselves. So this is not a self-help seminar.
But can I, so yes. I'm just trying yeah. to work with some stuff. But is a piece is sort of like looking at what you do and noticing where you're sort of not choosing, you're letting habits choose.
Yeah.
And that's not you, that's sort of whatever, not you. You are not you, whichever one.
Okay, whatever the semantics, go on. Yeah.
But it's sort of that you do, and you suddenly realize, like, I'm just doing this stuff because it's habits, and mm-hmm. I'm reacting to things without even processing. And so it's sort of that stepping back and noticing.
It gives you flashes of freedom.
Right, that yeah. you could choose mm-hmm. to do that thing or not do that mm-hmm. thing. Instead of just doing it, because that's I always do that when this happens, I do that.
Yes, as we go along, we have an increased sense of freedom. We're lightening ourselves up, right? Yes. And that's not reinventing. That's the freedom to get out of samsara. As long as we don't manipulate it, it just comes to us. Yeah, we have a choice. We always have a choice. Every instant.
And so, but as a piece of sort of the clarifying confusion, is sort of noticing like where, oh, in this situation, I usually just do this, even though I don't get a benefit, it doesn't improve the situation, it's just the habit I have of reacting this mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And sort of the clarification, whatever, is sort of noticing there's the choice.
Yeah, it is creating wisdom, definitely.
It's like the fog lifts somehow. You know, you're caught in the fog and you're doing the same habitual thing over and over, and then you start to notice what it is, and then you realize there is a choice, just as you said. You could actually do something different.
Or so your clarity, the clarity that emerges through direct perception, actually is it weakens the stranglehold of the confusion itself. But in seeing what it is, what you're seeing with is your fundamental sanity. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then the confusion itself ceases to become a problem. It drops. You're free from it. I mean, old habits die hard, but...
I'm all good with that.
That's true.
Okay. So, last week we talked about a scheme called the Five Skandhas. We're going to go briefly over that. But to put it into context, the Five Skandhas are a way of understanding how a moment of confusion happens. Just a moment. Then we're going to get onto the second part of what we want to talk about tonight, which is why we keep why it recycles itself so that we have more and more moments, and that's where we're going to turn to the wheel. So first there's what is a moment of confusion, then there's why do they keep happening one after another, what keeps that wheel spinning. So the first one is called the Five Skandhas, and they are happening now. It's not a theory of developmental psychology or how we got here. It's what's happening right now. And again, right now. Every moment. And it actually takes some amount of time for a process we described as a bubbling up, starting from the first skandha until it bursts up into consciousness. It takes a little bit of time. And while that's happening, the next one's coming up, and the next one's coming up. So they're coming up in profusion. A lot of skandha process is happening. So it's actually very good that skandha is happening in this moment, that it's not a piece of history, because that means that liberation, freedom from it, is also in this moment. Those two have to go together. So the skandhas are a map of an instant of confusion, or one spark of samsara. The theory of it, the schema, is very useful because it's a real way to make sense of how the world happens if you actually put your mind on it and don't try to just say this is some old Tibetan piece of nonsense. Because it allows you to make sense of the world at every possible level. It's both medieval and highly scientific. And it's both of those, because what it's saying is that the tiniest little detail, a little sense of me being separated from the world, builds up into something momentous, and it happens at every level of us and of the world in general. So it's a story of how confusion takes over, how wars and revolutions happen, how the ecology of the earth gets destroyed. So it really is a powerful explanatory way. It's not that there has to be five. I'm sure people have other maps and so on, but understanding the process is meaningful. In scientific terms, this is called systems theory. And a lot of systems theory has come to agree with what we're saying here. If you want to look that up, I have some very nice books about it. But we can't go into that now. And also from being one with our breath and dropping samsara for a moment, we can understand again at many levels how evolution happens, how creativity happens, how peace happens on every possible level, including the world. So if we can turn this from some sort of technical idea into an understanding, it's a very powerful way for us to have wisdom in how the whole world operates. So to go over them very quickly, only about a minute now, so we can get on. So the first skandha is the experience of self and other. And I don't want to spend any time why that happens, what causes it, and so on at this point. Just that the first skandha is the embryonic sense of there's me and there's something else. So we all have that experience, is that correct? Mm-hmm. I'm having my experience. You're having a different experience. Each one of us has a very solid sense of me. We're not looking at it from a Buddha's point of view, but from our own point of view. We really feel, I exist, and this is what's happening. Does everyone experience it that way? Mm-hmm. Okay, good, then we don't have to recommend a psychiatrist. Okay, now can you see that as soon as that happens, it guarantees that there's suffering? Why is that? It's a very simple logic. Why does having a sense of me and other, experience the world as me and other, guarantee suffering?
Either the other is better off in some way, and so I'm unhappy about it, or I'm better off, and then I have to worry that it might swap, and I'll be worse. I have to worry about sort of what's the relationship there.
Yeah, that's a...
Well, if there's an I and an other, then there's difference. And there's difference. And as soon as you see difference,
yeah,
then there's either something you like or you don't like.
Right. So we're moving on to the next skandha,
so
too. Both of you.
The difference creates tension that can create suffering.
Right. But more fundamentally, if this world out there is something that's out there and I'm here, then there's a huge amount of what's going on that I have no control over. There's a world there and I can't control it. I can't control my own body growing old and getting weaker. I can't control wars and violence. Some things may be going on that I like, but basically there's a world that's the world is out of control because it's out there and I'm here. We almost have to come to that conclusion if I'm a self and there's stuff out there that's not self. Isn't that true? We're not in control. Okay, so the other skandhas, as has been pointed out, because there's something out there, I may not like it, or I may like it, or I might not care. So we have the instinctive attitude or feeling, which is the second skandha, feeling. And then we have the third skandha, which is reacting. That is, I perceive it from my particular ego-centered view, and I react to it. And there's a lot of habit there, as you pointed out. And from traditional Buddhist point of view, it's habit that's been going on for eons of rebirths. If you don't necessarily buy that, at least it's habit that's pretty deeply ingrained in us, that we react to things before we even know much about them. And then there's the fourth one. Did you follow 1, 2, 3? Okay. The fourth one is called formation or concept. And that's about producing a whole lot of thoughts. Because since I'm here and that's out there, what am I going to do? Am I going to include things as part of me and my safe world, like my neighbors, because I like them, as opposed to the enemies? Or whatever it is, each moment we have to justify our existence and what I'm about and what the outside thing is about. And there's always a different outside. So there's always a lot of mental furniture having to be moved. This takes a lot of effort. We take up a lot of energy in this thing called concept, the fourth skandha. And most of it happens without our even being aware of it. That is, we see all the time that people will say something and it's their opinion and they can't come up with why, because the why belongs to the fourth skandha, which is, until we start to look at it, somewhat unconscious. We're not paying much attention to why we believe what we believe, why we think we're right, why our religion is right, why our country is right, why I'm right, or wrong, or whatever. So there's a lot of ideology being formulated here. And I'm going to give you a little sample of that later. So the fifth skandha is called consciousness. And that's not a highly praiseworthy term. In fact, it actually means a moment of deluded consciousness, of a moment of duality, of suddenly all this bubble has reached the surface, and now this consciousness is the story of me. I think I carried my little cheat sheet here. Can you see it? I look down on it if I don't know what the answer is. See? You can have one too. And what it says is, it's all about me.
Well, it is.
It is, right? The first skandha is about me and something else. The second skandha is my attitude. The third skandha is how I react. The fourth skandha is the semi-conscious justifications that I'm using. And the fifth skandha is my story.
Okay.
Yeah?
Well, gosh, got that. It's all sewn up.
Right.
No place in there.
Anyone want to comment on that? This is my story. So my story turns out to have a lot of issues with it. It turns out to be very selective. The memories are inaccurate. In fact, we set down memories in which the time is wrong, because the skanda process comes along, and after something's already happened, it takes ownership. This happened because of me, and then we remember it from when it, we date the memory from when it really happened, but actually we formed the memory later. So it falsifies time. And anyone trying to cross-examine a witness will learn this pretty quickly, that people can't explain why they believe or say what they say. They aren't accurate about their timing. Memories are all wrong, because what we remember is the story of me, the fifth skanda. Trungpa Rinpoche says, I'm going to give you two little quotes. One is, the intuitive intelligence of the second skanda, you read this last week, the energy of the third, and the intellectualizing of the fourth combine to produce thoughts and emotions. The fifth skanda, we find uncontrollable and illogical patterns of discursive thought, that is, eruptions of thoughts and emotions. This is the official story of me. This is what I did. This is why I did it. Then he says something interesting. Primordial intelligence is operating all the time, but it is being employed by the dualistic fixation ignorance. Did anyone get that? No. No, that's hard. I'm going to repeat that. Primordial intelligence is operating all the time. That is our original nature, which is unconfused, it hasn't gone to sleep. It's been put in the employment of confusion. In other words, it's been hijacked. So the fact that our intelligence has been hijacked is evidence that our intelligence hasn't disappeared. It's still there. It's just being used in a strange way. It is the original energy that's being used to create the delusion. It's not the delusion. The delusion doesn't have any energy. It can only use our primordial strength and intelligence. It just has to hijack it.
So the ego is actually taking advantage of some of the characteristics of our Buddha nature.
Yeah. Right, and at the same time it doesn't even exist. But it's at this moment, it's a momentary existence, and then we're going to see that there's another momentary existence, so the hijacking goes on.
It's like when you meditate, and you can see this maybe more clearly, that there are these gaps where you do contact the primordial intelligence, but then the confusion layers right on top of that with the next thought. So it seems to always be like cycling around in terms of what you can penetrate through to that primordial intelligence momentarily, and then the thought arises again. Does that relate to what you're
yes,
saying?
Yes, absolutely. Because
the fourth Dharma Gampoko, which we started this conversation with, grant your blessings of the confusion may dawn as wisdom, means you discover the fundamental natural intelligence that is actually being cloaked by the confusion itself. Mm-hmm. So that as you begin to really see the confusion, there's lifts, and you can see through that and be free of it, then you realize fundamentally you have this natural wisdom that's the wisdom mind that's basically the true nature of everybody and everything.
It dawns.
It dawns.
Beautiful
right.
Word, dawn.
Yeah. Yeah. May confusion make dawn as wisdom, right. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to read a very brief poem here that is quite funny, actually, that I found in a book called The Illusion of Free Will, a modern psychological book that deals with skanda.
Where do you find these things?
Well, it's actually right at the beginning of the book, before he even talks about anything, he presents this. A leaf was riven from a tree. I mean to fall to earth, said he. The west wind rising made him veer. Eastward, said he, I now shall steer. The east wind rose with greater force, said he, 'twere wise to change my course. With equal power they contend, he said, my judgment I suspend. Down died the winds, the leaf elate cried, I've decided to fall straight. Okay, so this is about the fourth and fifth skanda. Do you see that?
The winds are all about me.
Yeah, in other words, whatever is going on, each decision is a piece of fifth skanda. I've decided this, I've decided that. Now this leaf sounds like a pretty contented one, not one fighting his fate. But you can get into worse battles than this for sure. But the fourth skanda is the creating the justification so that now we can say, I decided, which is the fifth skanda. Mm-hmm. I decided this is what I'm going to do. Not something came along and knocked me. I have free will. I'm going to prove I exist. This is my story. This is by Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary, written in 1911.
1911?
Yeah, but quoted. I have never read him, actually.
Ambrose Bierce.
He was a close friend of Mark Twain's and, a sardonic, a humorist and tremendously profoundly critical of the human condition.
American? English?
Yeah, he's an American.
American, okay. Thank you. Okay, so that's the story of how a moment of confusion happens. So, anything anyone wants to say about that? Or unsay?
We're probably all confused.
What? We're all confused. Right.
And now we're confused again.
Then we're confused again. Okay, so, this is called the wheel of existence, or sometimes the wheel of life. This happens to be a tanka, which is simply a Tibetan word for a painting. But most tankas are of sacred things, like teachers, the Buddha, or a teacher like Padmasambhava, or something like that, or a deity. This is not something we would put up on a shrine, because it's a story of confusion, and it is intended as a teaching device, the wheel of existence. And the wheel is being held by
Yama.
Right. Yama is...
Yeah, very death. Good.
Right, yeah.
Lord of death.
Lord of death, Yama.
Lord of death.
Okay. And he's holding this wheel, which is cycling and cycling. And in the center of the wheel are the three poisons which come up with our attitude of like, dislike, and indifference. And I don't think you can really see them too well. This is a cock and a rooster, whatever. Right. In any case, he wants to seduce. He wants to attract. So he's looking to... it could be called passion or attachment. Wants to bring in the world. This is the way of relating to the world. I like it. I want to bring it in. Then, and you can't see it really, there's a snake. And the snake is looking out at the world and contemplating attacking it.
Yeah. Why is the rooster in the middle?
He's over on the left.
It's dark. That's all. It's just really dark.
There are three. You can't see it.
Okay. So it doesn't have greater prop. They're equal.
They're equal.
They're
yeah.
Chasing each other, right?
Right.
Because they keep going around and around. We don't just do one of them. We do all of them. Now you may say that There are other ways to use animals, and there certainly are. We can use them as any kind of metaphor we want, so this is just a particular choice. But here it is. In this case, the pig is... I bring this up because people say, well, pigs are really intelligent, which they are, I think. But this pig is looking down, and the only thing he's paying attention to is what's right in front of him, so he can pick it up and eat it and chew his way along and ignore everything else going on.
Ignorance.
That's ignorance, yeah. Mm-hmm. The three poisons and the three attitudes and three ways of reacting to the world. So this is what's stirring up samsara. The next ring shows samsara cycling, in that here is someone who's in a pretty good realm, and we'll get to the realms in a minute, and falling down, whoop, into the hell realm. And these people are going up, the situation's getting better, and then they get into a very pleasurable God realm. But God realms are not permanent any more than any other part of samsara. So the wheel keeps going round. There's no, as long as you're on the wheel.
You don't get to stay anywhere.
Pardon?
You don't get to go to some really good place and stay there.
You could for a while. Some of these can be, you can dwell for a long time.
Depending on your karma. If you have really good karma, too good karma for your own good, you get reborn in a God realm. And you can stay there for eons. The problem is, as long as you're still in this wheel, you're going to end up just basically like everything else. Once things start happening like this, you take it totally for granted and you fall asleep. So, and then all the beings in the God realm are going to dump out, because what happens is, even though they're perfect and they have no flaws and enjoy extraordinary sensual delights and have everything they want and they go wherever they want instantly, and every wish gets desired, that they desire to become satisfied, they begin to start, as this whole thing starts to fall apart, they start noticing flaws like spots, age spots, and they start to scrub them, and they can't get off, and then they become ugly.
Okay.
That's what happens, is you drop out.
Yep, okay.
And you'll be born in the lower realm.
So you've surely noticed that people in the God realm who are self-absorbed and uncompassionate. And there's another one over here, which is called the jealous gods. And these are the ones who are, at this moment, envious of the gods. These are the people who, who've made it. These are the people who want to make it and are envious and are attacking so that they can get up there into a pleasure realm. But right now, what's on their mind is warfare, to conquer so they can get the pleasure.
Is there a reason that there looks to be like an overlap between those two realms?
Yeah, because they're sort of
because that line, it looks like
it's not as clear as the other ones separated.
There is a line.
Oh, there is a line.
Yeah.
There is a line, but you can see that these guys are crossing the line.
That's it. They're pushing in.
In the Ramayana, the Hindu epic,
Ramayana,
is all about basically the struggle of the Asuras against the devas, which are the beings that are occupying the heaven realm. And the devas always win, even though the Asuras are very crafty, extraordinarily intelligent, and working all the time to achieve and, you know, making all these efforts. But they can never get to that level.
So we're going to have to move on.
Yeah.
So the human realm is a realm where sometimes things are going fine, and sometimes they're painful, and we get to experience both of these. And because of the alteration, and because we actually have a mind that can pay attention here, not absorbed in warfare or bliss, we have a chance to wake up, and that's shown by the fact that this is the only realm generally from which there's an exit. There's a Buddha up here, and people are...
And there's a Buddha in the realm.
And
they're listening to the Dharma, those people sitting in front. Yeah.
So this is us. We have a chance to hear the Dharma. And then there are this is the animal realm, and animal means basically going on automatic pilot, stupidity, doing things by habit, and very seldom waking up to have any spacious thoughts. And there's another realm called the hungry ghosts. And the problem with the hungry ghosts is that they can't get satisfaction, not because necessarily they can't get anything to drink, but because they can't swallow it. No matter what happens, they can't get any satisfaction. It's
They have huge bellies and very long necks, and they're constantly choking on the whatever they put in their mouth, so it never gets down to their stomachs, and they're in this constant state of craziness to, you know, to get grab and hold and to acquire.
So this is greed, and the last one is hell realm, and there are hot realms and cold, hot and cold hells, but hell is an angry place, and there's no escape from samsara because there's no space to have any thought except how awful this is and how intolerably painful it is.
It seems to me that anybody in the upper realm with all the stuff and the people over there could also very easily be in those realms at the same time. They're not exclusive.
Oh, not only are they not exclusive, but one can be born into a realm in any instant. And that is the nature of samsara. That is, along comes a particular skanda development, bang, we're in a different realm. We could go from hell to hungry ghost to human to whatever, to blissed out. We can move very quickly through realms.
Simultaneously.
What?
I'm saying you can be simultaneous. You can be
maybe
ignorant and up in, what's that top realm called?
Yeah.
The God realm.
They
actually share characteristics because each of these six realms are either passion, aggression, or ignorance. God realm is ignorance, as is the animal realm. The
realm.
And then the greater realm and the human realm are related also from passion.
So there are.
Yeah. Okay. A moment of consciousness is singular. They can come very fast, and our story creates continuity, so they seem to be all happening. But at any instant is actually in one place, and it's moving very quickly.
What you're saying. Kind of like when you get to when you're talking about the skandhas.
What?
The skandhas are about
skandhas.
Skandhas happen in one moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So these can also be. One
yeah, you could be triggered by anger,
yeah.
And you know you're ready to sock someone.
Right, and then something happens, and we wake up, and bang, we're in the human realm, and we have a moment of reflecting on it, and so on. And the outer realm, which I'm not going to cover at all, but it is on the website if you want to look at it, is called 12 Nidanas, and it's an explanation of karma, an explanation of why. We move from one to another. It's pretty complicated, and I can't open that subject at all right now. There's a reading on the website for it. So that's the 12 Nidanas in the fourth of these circles. And it's going round and round and round. Now, this issue of being reborn. We're reborn every instant, possibly in a different realm. There are two ways to understand the subject of rebirth, at least two ways. One is it's happening every moment because we're in samsara, we are continuously reinventing ourselves. So we're being reborn. Another way to understand it from a traditional point of view is when a person dies, according to their karma, they get reborn in some other situation. And that is very traditional Buddhism. Buddhism evolved in the context of Indian civilization in which the idea of rebirth was very prominent, it was not questioned. Buddhism also radically modified it because it denied that rebirth had anything to do with caste or was an excuse for holding people in a fixed situation in their life. Mm-hmm. So in that way it differs from the Hindu notion of rebirth. So you can decide that you like the idea of rebirth and want to believe in it, or that you don't want to believe in it. And I'm going to just make a very brief remark, which is, my teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, never at any time in his teachings did I ever hear him say that we should believe in rebirth in a sense of a future possibility. Nor did he ever say it doesn't exist, there is no such thing. He never addressed that question in his entire teaching, as far as I know, and I've read an awful lot of his teaching, and it's immense. From my point of view, if you want to believe in rebirth, then you have a problem that the self is impermanent, so we really don't know what it is that's going to get reborn. We don't understand it from our confused situation. It's hard to understand what that would be, and I can't tell you what it would be.
Except that...
Well, I want to go on, okay? I don't have time to get into a philosophical discussion of it at all.
Oh boy.
And you also have the issue, if you have a scientific mind, that science doesn't have any way of accommodating such a thing as far as we know. So there's a problem with believing it, I think. There's also a problem with not believing it, which is that it gives you a nihilistic world in which if things just disappear, then things are meaningless, and we still don't get any answer to why is anything happening at all? Why is there experience? Why are beautiful things happening as well as awful things? It doesn't have any explanatory power.
Why so, does that need to be explained?
That's what I'm saying. That to me, to take a position one way or another in a rigid way is a problem, so I can't take a position. You can if you want.
No, I just wanted to call attention to the fact that we were talking about rebirth in terms of the five skandhas starting last week. When Buddhism talks about rebirth, they talk about it in terms of a rebirth that's occurring psychologically from moment to moment, mm-hmm. or in the context of any given moment.
Yeah.
And then that, because it was actually comes from a culture, and certainly Tibetans and Hindus, all Indians believe in reincarnation. Rinpoche actually did say, I have, somebody else is going to find out, so I just want to clarify this. I was just reading it today in the second volume of Found Treasure. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple thing. If you want to know where your former life, look at where your thoughts come from. If you want to know where you're going to be reborn, and look where your thoughts are going. I mean, this is basically talking
right.
about, we're not positing that therefore there's a next, you know, we don't know what
that's
that means, but we do know that we have the opportunity to take responsibility for the tendencies we experience and actually work on those, mm-hmm. as opposed to just being washed downstream. That, and so that's the difference between, that's the human one, the unique opportunity that we have as humans, is we can actually do that.
That's a very good point.
Thank goodness.
In other words, what Buddhism is doing is making us take total responsibility for what's happening now. No excuses that someone else did it or anything. We are responsible for the world we are experiencing right now, and that's our karma. Mm-hmm. And we have right now the possibility of producing something different. So we always have something inherited and the possibility of having something different. That's quite scientific. It's like saying this is the momentum we come in with, and this is the change we can make in it.
Unless you're Pavlov. Pavlov, with the Pavlovian notion that we'll just make sure we condition people to become reborn as good Soviet citizens of modern the new humanity, which will serve, the local dictator and ensure that the vision will be fulfilled. But this is actually marvelous. It's worth studying. Which of the explanations that we like did we put on the website?
It's from the Rubin Museum.
Oh, from the Rubin Museum.
Yeah, and they break it down into the rings. It's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. It's
we
a really
put that
great
on, and we put
tool.
On Garuda, the first Garuda.
The Garuda. Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah, so yeah. You have two sources, and both of them will name and identify the Nidanas if you want to see them. They circle this sort of order. So, there's a teacher, and you'll find her on our website under resources, Khandro Rinpoche. I think she's a very great teacher, a present teacher. And she had this to say when students were saying, well, what can I do to to be reborn, to have a better rebirth? And what she said was, that's the wrong question to be asking. You've already got it as good as it gets, and you better make use of it. this birth that we have right now is what's, first of all, it's a precious human birth, free and well-favored. That's a common Buddhist expression. And what that means is that we are not only have a human situation, but we have an excellent one because we have at least some leisure in our life and because we've actually heard teachings saying that there's something beyond immediate materialism and we can start to understand it. So we have the best possible circumstances. We have a precious human life free. We have time to do this if we want to make it, and well-favored. We've come to a place where someone has mentioned Dharma and we can start to open our minds. So we're in a very fortunate situation. Nevertheless, it is said that renunciation leads to better rebirth. And Emily made some comment on that during the meditation.
I did.
Yeah, you did.
I did? What did I say?
Well, we're talking about what is renunciation. And in some context, renunciation means I'm going to leave my family life, I'm going to go to a monastery or become a wandering yogi, I'm going to give away all my wealth, I'm going to be celibate, I'm going to be very strict in my diet and so forth. These are all possible things that people do under the general rubric of renunciation. Renunciation, as we can most immediately put it into practice during our meditation, is that when we go back to our breath, we just spaciously be the breath. Be with that space. As opposed to saying, well, that was a juicy thought, and that's what
I
you said.
That, yeah.
Yeah, that was a juicy thought. I'm going to take it 3 or 4 steps further, then I'll go back to my breath. And that's not renunciation.
Right.
So it can feel like frustration. It actually is giving up something. And it's the most fundamental thing we can give up is not to follow our chain of thoughts, but to allow space. This is not anti-intellectual. When it's time to think, then we think, and we think as accurately as we can without compulsion or circularity. But most of what's going on while we're meditating is chewing our cud. And we can renounce chewing our cud because that is renunciation that cuts through karma. So, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I would, because I also post-meditation, what we call post-meditation mode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
When we're off the cushion, we don't have this necessarily the space to always just simply drop everything and, sort of go back to our breath. It's like recognizing attachment. Renunciation, non-attachment is fundamental renunciation. When we actually learn that we're being tied down, when Michael talked about being hijacked by samsara, that actually manifests in terms of our attachments. And so when we begin to encounter our experiences and realize how our attachments are constantly coming up in terms of our experience, in terms of biases, preferences, and things that we think we own and hold on to, and as we learn how to work with that, that is basically a major act of renunciation. You're simply letting it drop and exercising and discovering a freedom that is fundamentally already there as a result of which you begin to experience, which otherwise you're just trapped with all your belongings and goods and stuff, problems and issues. I hope that wasn't too much.
I think it was just right. Does anyone else have anything they would like to say, have clarified, have confused? Yeah.
At the end of what you said cut through the karma. And I was curious what, maybe a little clarification on that, if it's possible.
Karma is the speed and momentum with which we come to the present situation, which keeps us going and repeating us, right? So cutting through it is to start to change it. We can't instantly change. It's going too fast. It's like a big ship. And we can't instantly take this ship and go whoosh. If you take this ship and start to apply some other force, then each time you apply some other force, it's going to change it, right? This is kind of the laws of physics. So karma is the momentum with which we come into to our present situation, and cutting through karma is the space that allows us to start to change it. Or as Michael said before, how did you say it? What we bring from the past and what we can do in the future. Karma is what comes from the past, and freedom is what we can start to apply in the future. Anyone else? So I think that's kind of it. So to summarize, we study suffering and the cause of suffering to transcend it, to have liberation in the path. The possibility of cessation is a great motivation. It will take exertion. We have to work against fear. And that's very real. As we go forward, we're actually undermining our very rigid identity. And we're doing it in a way which is not going to make us crazy, but make us free. Because we aren't tampering with things, we're illuminating them. So it does take energy, and it does take determination, and it does take using our intelligence to start to overcome samsara. And we have some sort of a schema. It's not the only one. Theistic religions have different schemas, and I wouldn't go so far as to say they can't work. There are lots of ways to explain mind. This one is free of belief in external deities. And that's about it. We actually can do that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Oh.
When you said we're not tampering with things, we're illuminating them.
Yeah.
So you could say that's what we're doing in meditation. We're not really to tamper with the mind.
Right, we're told that all the time.
We're into and tampering it would be following thought. That's one
yeah. That's one way to do it. Another would be to say, I want
to
sit
judge
down.
Judge it,
yeah.
Maybe say, oh, go, I don't like that thought.
Yeah.
That's tampering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or I want to get a blissful peace state, which there are techniques that,
right.
that one can use
yeah.
to make that happen. And we don't teach those.
Right. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out one thing here on the wheel. Over here, this figure, this mudra, it's called a mudra. It's called the Abhaya Mudra, and it's fearlessness. So it's very interesting from what you just said, Michael, about fear and fearlessness. That Buddha on the far right with his hand raised. So I think overcoming fear, being willing to work with fear and go through this process of stripping away, ego we talked about in the beginning, and non-self, and we'll keep cycling back to work with that more and more. But it takes a lot of willingness to look and really, really go into this because the ego does not want to do that. So it takes courage. So I just wanted to.
With that schema that we brought up and we discussed suffering, that topic, talking about hope and fear and how hope and fear create the eight worldly dharmas, that's all there as points of contemplation or potential reference when you start to encounter fear. You go, well, where does it lie? What am I really afraid of? What's the fear about? Is this actually what we're talking about? Yeah. Oftentimes fear is just sort of without an object. It's sort of like you're just sitting there quivering. And that's pretty much a first skanda kind of thing where, it's happening so fundamentally on such a fundamental level. All you know is there's a split and you're uncomfortable. You discover that. And that translates to a sort of fear. Like it's really not at ease. Really the meaning of not being at ease.
A general sense of the bottom. Falling out. That's how I've experienced it in a long sitting period of a month. The Buddha appears all over the place. This is the human realm he's teaching in the human realm. Because humans can hear the Dharma. Now what's he doing in the, what's he doing in the Hungry Ghost realm? He can't teach them.
Well, they do try to, there is a Buddha that comes up in every realm, right? That
right.
tries to help and liberate, or
so
a Bodhisattva.
He's offering them something soothing and helpful to drink, or
I
in any case,
know.
I'm not sure what he's doing in here with the animals, and maybe he's just whacking them to wake them up.
I don't know.
Where does the exit from the human realm lead you? What's that up there on the left?
This is the open spaciousness of the original nature.
Okay, and is that the path?
This is
cutting through
the path.
And cutting through this particular set of nidanas, these two nidanas, where that's the point where you don't have to simply experience a chain link kind of movement that just locks us from one phase of confusion to the next. And so that particular area is between
Fixation and grasping.
When we can actually get between the fixation and grasping.
So you notice that you want it, but then you realize you can break that cycle right at that point between the grasping and the actual fixation on it.
So that's renunciation. When you
give
that particular obsession, there's an opening. And that opening is basically the way out.
That's the way out. That's the link that's broken.
Where does this come from? How far back does it go? Any idea?
Well,
who was the first person that painted it?
I don't know. It would be Tibetan, and it would have to be after 1000 AD. It's not like this particular format probably doesn't go back to the Buddha. Maybe it can.
This conceptually does not go back to the Buddha. That's what I'm wondering.
That's
this whole concept.
Question. Yeah. I don't think it was invented by a particular person who's gone down in history.
No.
But it's a map that summarizes the fundamental basis of human. And
but
by
did the
way,
Buddha start this?
Hmm?
Did he have a picture like this?
No.
No.
Did the Buddha taught
a lot about the psychological aspects that are here.
Right.
He didn't write anything down.
But I think also people were illiterate. I'm making this up, but you can correct me. But they didn't always you couldn't read and write.
Right.
So you have images, and you teach through images,
right.
And it helps people understand what's being expressed.
Yes.
So it's a teaching tool.
Responsible.
I don't know about that.
This one's like that, yeah.
Because there are different versions of this, of course, and different orders. So don't be frightened or surprised when you see things placed in different ways.
Okay.
It's not like, you know, one thing and that's it. It's a fixed. So go beyond that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.